So today, our Meet the MDT podcast, we have Kalyan Goli, who has worked at our practice as a healthcare assistant for many years. How many years is
it? It's about 3.5 years.
Okay. Yeah. So we wanted to introduce to the students about your role in the practice. And then I was also really keen for them to meet you because you've had a big role in our local hot hub, haven't you?
That's right. Hello, everyone. My name is Kalyan Goli. I work as a healthcare assistant. So recently, since end of March, I've been working in the Ealing Community Escalation Center, which you commonly call it as Hot Hub. And I work there as a healthcare assistant. And my role basically involves supporting the GPs who are working there when they see the patients, and also administrative and infection control. That's my basic role, which I have been supporting since last 3.5 months. Usual day-to-day is make sure the whole location is completely infection-free, so cleaning and everything. And then we got GP consultation rooms where the patients don't go. So we have a system in place there where once a patient enters, it's a one-way traffic. So a patient enters, gets into the clinical room, we wait outside, and the GP enters, do the consultation and whatever the required examinations need to be done, that's done. And then GP comes out and there is again a clean room and a dirty room to hand off your PPE and wear your PPE. So the GP enters the dirty room and changes his hand off his PPE, and then we get the opportunity to go to the patient. And if there is any requirement to do any examination from our part, we do it. And then we escort the patient outside through a completely different door, exit door. So once the patient is exited, then we come back into the dirty room and off our PPE. Before that, we just go and clean the clinical room where the patient has been made to sit, and then hand off our PPE and then replace the whole PPE and everything. So there is always a clean room and a dirty room. So there is a system in place to avoid any infection control. That's the first part of the job. And the second part is helping the GPs diagnosing the symptoms or diagnosis by establishing the symptoms. And one of the main criteria for COVID is the O2 saturation levels. So we check the patient's blood pressure, temperature. That's the first thing. The second thing is we check the saturation levels, and anything below 94, we suspect the patient. And then lately we have observed that on exertion, most of the patients who have major symptoms of COVID, they usually drop out. Like I have seen patients dropping out to 83.
So for the medical students, you get the patients to then walk around the car park, or how are you doing this?
That's right. Yeah. So once we establish the initial O2 saturation levels, and then we ask, depending on the symptoms, we ask the patient to go and walk around the car park.
Okay.
And then ask them to come back. It's literally a few yards of walking. They come back and we look at the respiratory rate, how the patient is breathing, and breathing any breathlessness, signs of breathlessness, and finally the saturation levels. So depending on how low the levels are dropped, the GPs take the decision. Like, as I said, the patients, some patients have gone below 90 most of the time. So there are times where we have to call in the ambulance, and the ambulance usually used to establish that same thing what we just did, and then used to take them to the hospital. Sometimes we used to give a choice to the patient, that put them on antibiotics and then monitor it, the breathlessness, and if it's not going to below 94, I think that's where we ask the patient to be careful, monitor, and if the symptoms get worse, advise them to come back to us or go to the hospital straight.
So over the last few months, you've seen a lot of COVID patients, haven't
you? Yes,
you have.
Yeah.
You've really been on the front line.
That's right.
Yeah. Did you feel safe?
I mean, there was always a thought that, you know, we might not be safe. But right from the start, we had the masks.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, we used to take the patients to come inside. But as the time passed, we started analyzing, like, what is the best and safest method. So I think within a couple of weeks' time, we started the hub. We thought that it's not in the best interest of the patient or the clinicians to bring them inside the building.
Mm-hmm.
So we started monitoring them or reviewing them in the car park itself. So the part of that is we'll never let the patient get out of the car park for a car of their car And we always ask the patient to come by car if they can't drive or they don't have the car, to ask their friends or somebody who can. Mm-hmm. We always had that opportunity to do, and most of the patients were being driven or coming by themselves in a car. So that's the first step we have taken. Second thing is we never ask them to step out of the car until the point of when we check the saturation levels. Mm. So all the discussion was let the window a little bit down and have a discussion, establish the symptoms. And then when the point of exception comes, we step out away from the car and then give the patient space to walk out and come back and then again put the saturation. So I think we have taken the safety measures wherever okay. possible, and it's in open air. So I think we reduced the risk of attaining any COVID virus, but again, there is always a risk. So
yes, absolutely.
Taking as many precautions as possible was the choice there.
Again, the students might not be aware, but the idea was that all suspected community cases of COVID went to the hub, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and at the peak, you were pretty busy there, weren't you?
Yeah, initially, the phones used to just go mad. Every, I think, 5 minutes, we had a couple of patients because they used to call 111. The system was not established initially, so there was quite a backlog as well. But again, we caught up, and then it was peak for about a month, I think, month and a half. Then again, it's calmed down, and now recently in the last couple of weeks, I think 3 weeks maybe, I would say, it's quite flat now.
There's not many cases at all.
Not many, I think. Hardly we have 3-4 a day.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, it's a good news.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And we started doing swab testing initially and then antibody testing. So
yours came back negative, didn't they? We were just talking about that. That's good.
Yeah, that's good.
I think.
Yeah.
Now, in the practice, the students are going to be coming soon, but they're probably not aware of what your role might be.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell them what you do normally, normal times in the practice?
In my day-to-day work in the practice, I work under the supervision of the nurse and the GPs. And basically, I'm supporting the nurses. I mean, I'm allowed to do most of the things except few things like immunizations, some injections, and travel vaccinations and stuff like that are not allowed within the HCA role. But apart from that, I do diabetic reviews, food checks, asthma checks. Also, I have a certificate in ARTP, which is spirometry. So I can diagnose and assess spirometry. So that gives me an opportunity to review COPD cases and discuss with the GPs to start them on medication or review.
So you manage a lot of the COPD in our practice, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have quite a lot here.
Yeah, we got a lot, about 70 or 80 patients approximately.
Yeah, and for a small practice, that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
What is the part of your job you like the best?
I mean, patient interaction is the first thing, because that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And then
it's what we're missing a bit at the moment, isn't
exactly.
it? Yeah.
And then anything patient care, that's why I've been doing this. So I like COPD, that's my baby in this practice. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing which I enjoy quite a lot. Diabetic reviews. And also I interact quite a lot with the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So I know my patients, what their problems are, and then I follow it up through. So yeah, everything related to the patients.
Okay, yeah. Can you tell the students a bit about your background?
Okay, my background is I did my medicine in Europe, then I returned back to India and started practicing there.
Mm-hmm.
Due to some personal circumstances, I had to move to UK.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, various reasons, I didn't got my registration straight away. And then in the last few years, I've been trying to get my registration.
What does that involve?
Involve taking an exam. First of all, it involves proving a proficiency in English to a very high standards, which is giving IELTS, IELTS it's called, or OET exam, where you need to get about score of 8, which is, I mean, to a level for a non-English speaking person, it's quite a high score requirement. That's the first thing to prove your eligibility to do the licensing exam, which is PLAB. In PLAB, there are two parts, PLAB 1 and PLAB 2. PLAB 1 is more theory, multiple choice questions. And then PLAB 2 is more OSCEs. So once you do that, and then depending on your experience, the GMC will look at your registration.
Now, these exams have a horrific reputation.
Yeah, they do have. I'm not saying they are very difficult exams, but there is a different approach. These exams are not just about your clinical knowledge.
Yeah.
These exams are mostly about safe practicing and how the British system of medical practice. So it's quite different to what you are trained up as a foreign medical graduate. Is quite different to what you are trained as, what you have been told as. So the medical knowledge is the same. But about British standards, it's a little bit different, which you need to get used to. And moreover, you need a lot of dedication towards the exam, which working and doing the exams is not the right choice. But when you have a family to support and give the exams, it's a little bit difficult.
And they're very expensive.
Yeah, it costs about, I think the first one is about £250 something, and the second part is about £835 something.
Okay.
There are training centers. If you're going to the training centers and all these things, it costs a lot.
Yeah. I kind of want the students to be aware, because lots of HCAs that they meet have a similar background to you.
Yeah, I mean,
especially in London, I would say. Is that true? Or
I mean, in this area, most of the, because I'm one of the vice chairs for the Ealing CCT.
Okay.
HCS group, and yeah, we got quite a lot of people in a similar background. Some have actually given up and moved out of thinking of getting a registration, and actually keep meeting new people who recently moved and they're in the HCA role.
So bear in mind, when the students come to practices, you don't know what background the HCAs will have that you're working with.
That's true. I mean, many students, I mean, I used to see the students when they come here.
Yeah.
And many students, they don't know what my background is.
Yeah.
Some students like to chat, and some students, they just want me to show something.
Yes.
And then they don't get involved. So I mean, it's a two-way. I think we get to learn. I had few students where I had an opportunity to speak to them. They're quite open about their training, and we shared information, and they learned from me and I learned from them. Some basically just come and just observe, want the signature, take the signature.
They want their sign-offs.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Whereas really they could learn so much from you.
I mean, I think it's both ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because I think I had a very good interaction with one student. He was actually sharing his whole fifth year of training, his syllabus and everything, and how different it is to my training.
Yes.
And everything.
Yeah.
So that was quite an informative thing for me and for him as well. So
that would be the ideal, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think the students are so trained in patient-centered care.
Yeah.
And consultation skills.
That's right.
And you could share a lot of your medical knowledge with them.
Yeah.
Because again, the students haven't been out on the front line like you, which in some ways is good.
Yeah.
Can you describe some of the COVID cases that you've seen, and maybe some background and, you know, some stories?
Okay. A couple of things I mean, it dominates my memory is one lady, Iranian lady background wise, we've seen her last month, and that was her second visit. Before that, she came to us in first week of April, I think, with initial symptoms of breathlessness, slight temperature and sore throat. Her examination was fine, so suspected COVID, asked her to isolate and put her on antibiotics. Gone past 6 weeks, she calls back again, 111, and then she's asked to come back. A surprising thing is the husband brings her back. And he is completely immune, like he doesn't have any symptoms. So we expect like he has spent 6 weeks with the wife and he doesn't have any symptoms, but her symptoms were getting worse.
Gosh, 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her saturation levels are about 94, I think, slight temperature again, but the cough has gone worse. There is not much change in saturation levels. And we didn't have any option of testing her, but she was sounding very COVID symptoms.
Because I think the students might not be aware at the time we couldn't test people, could we?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So we didn't have much choice, and we didn't feel like she needs attention in the hospital. So again, we asked her to continue isolate, and that's one of the major patients, like 6 weeks. But we had more and more patients having symptoms for more than a month.
Yes, yeah. Yeah,
and then again, the partners are completely fine. They never had any symptoms, although they are helping them, staying with them. So that was a bit of a question mark for us.
Yeah.
Like, why one person is...
almost immune.
Yeah, almost yeah. immune.
And I think we know now that people are getting sort of post-COVID lung and
yeah.
losing lung capacity,
that's
aren't
right.
they? But we
yeah.
didn't know that at the beginning.
No. I mean, most of the patients with lung problems, like COPD patients, first thing is we don't know whether they're COVID or not because we hadn't had much of testing done at that time.
Mm.
That was the peak when we couldn't test many patients. We didn't have the facilities. So I can never say these are COVID patients or not, but the symptoms are always directing us towards that. The saturation levels were dropping. The other thing, sad part is like once we send them to the hospital, because they were registered temporarily with us, we had very less opportunity to follow it up or,
yeah.
on the case to see like what they has happened to them. It was always like we monitor the symptoms, diagnose something, and then send them to the hospital, and then we are blank. We don't know what has happened.
Yeah.
But I can only speak from the symptoms point of view. It was quite odd. Many patients had 6 weeks or long symptoms. Some patients had 2 weeks. Some patients never showed any symptoms. And then suddenly, you know, they had some symptoms. And then other interesting bit is most of the key workers,
yes.
like the nurses and the TFL, we had a lot of those people who turned up saying they have symptoms. And one more important case is, I think, a nurse. I think it's not just one, two nurses we know. One worked for University College London, I think,
mm-hmm.
University Hospital London. And she has been diagnosed because she's working in a hospital. The hospital tested her and she was on a swab. She came up positive. So because of the facilities, she was tested every week.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay. And she has been positive every week except for 1 week in between.
For how many weeks?
6 weeks.
Gosh. So our guidelines stay at home for a week.
Yeah, but she was
positive. They were not enough, were they?
And she didn't have any symptoms, I think, till the 6th week.
Really?
Yeah.
So where she was tested at hospital, found to be positive,
yeah.
and then she came back to you for swabs.
She came to us on the 6th week saying, I have symptoms.
Gosh. Yeah.
So I think I'm clear now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So she was carrying the virus for 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
And potentially infectious.
Yeah. So when we looked at her history, only 1 week she was, one of the weeks in the 6 weeks she was negative, but every week she was positive. And she had the symptoms in the 6th week when the doctors put her on antibiotics. I think she was fine after that. But, you know, that was really...
There's so much we don't know.
Yeah, so much we don't know about the virus, yeah.
Yeah, and we probably didn't always err on the side of caution because we were trying to keep the workforce going.
Yeah, that's yeah. right, yeah.
Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and some people were tested negative, but they had quite a lot of severe symptoms.
Yeah.
And they were tested negative.
I mean, they do say the swabs have got better, don't they?
Yeah.
And the ELISA tests
yeah.
or whatever it is have got
that's
better.
Right. Yeah.
Gosh, okay. So the students are coming back out sort of end of August, beginning of September.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to any students coming to the practice? What's your advice?
If they're very keen, instead of just going for, because I've seen most of the students want it to be signed off first.
Yes.
So
we roll our eyes sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, so I think first of all, getting to know the overall practice, how it operates, like from GPs to the lowest person, like receptionist, how it operates. And then getting to know the day-to-day, the working principle of the, in the sense of GPs and then the nurses and the healthcare assistants and the admin team, secretaries, how the, so that gives them a very good idea, like whole system of the patient care from right from the patient approaching the GP, then what are the care they get from the nurse or the HCA and the referral process where the admin and the secretary
mm-hmm.
deals with.
So how it all fits together.
Yeah, all fits yeah. together. Because I think if they ever want to get into a GP practice, I think that gives them a good idea. Because when they go into a hospital, because there is always, I see that, oh, the GP has done this or GP has done this or they could have done like that. But if you have an idea how the GP practice works, because obviously they will go to hospital and work, it would be a good learning curve for them that, okay, this is how the process works in a GP. So I think if the approach to the patient in the hospital will be a very good instead of just sending a letter or, you know, so I think that gives them a very good understanding. The second thing is a learning curve, like how, because I think most of the follow-up and the care happens in a GP practice. Because once the patient is discharged from the hospital, from a hospital point of view, because I worked in hospitals, I know, like, we don't know what's happening in the community, how the care is. So understanding how the patient approaches the GP or the admin team, and then how he's being followed up. So I think in that way, you have a good understanding, you know, how a community or family medicine runs for the patient. And learning the basic things, I'm sure they learn in the hospital as well, but, you know, the GP consultation, how much time they get, how much time they can spend on a patient, because there's a lot of backlog and the GP has to really work on it. And then on top of that, how much time a nurse gets, because you hardly get any information about what has happened or the further follow-up. Like, sometimes you don't even get whether it's a sutures or clips put on a patient.
On the wound.
On patient wound. So you just know the patient has been operated, but what's the further follow-up? It's like you have to open the wound and then see, oh, it's clips or it's sutures. So it's the hospital, I mean, the letters what we get fail to give much information on that. So, yeah, so that kind of things can be improved, like, you know, once you work in the hospital. So,
understand the whole context.
Yeah, really. That's right.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome.